This is December 16th, 2007, and I'm going to this Tesha will be on giving. Tis the season, and there is so much that, so many aspects to giving, different kinds of giving, and I'm going to turn to one of the best overviews of Buddhist doctrine. This is not Zen specifically, but it's called A Survey of Buddhism by Sangharakshita. It's a Buddhist monk, very now in his 80s, I think, in England, who started this big organization in England called the Friends of the Western Buddhist Order. Sangharakshita really knows Buddhist doctrine. And here in this book, there is a section on dana, or giving. D-A-N-A is the Sanskrit word that means giving or charity or generosity. And it's the first of what are called the six perfections. The six perfections are giving, morality, patience, vigor, or our effort, mindfulness or concentration, and wisdom. And these are the six aspects of Buddhist practice that are both cause and effect, that cultivating these six perfections is a way to expedite one's awakening, and also from long practice and awakening come these six are developed. But generally speaking, the first, dana, or giving, is considered the most fundamental one of them all, as we'll hear as we read from this. He says that that dana may be considered from four different points of view. The first is to whom a gift is given, what is given, how it is given, and why or with what motive it is given. The first one, to whom it is given, they traditionally cite three classes of recipients: one's own friends and relatives, the poor, the sick, the afflicted, and the helpless, and the members of the Sangha. We're going to skip over that and go to the next one, what is given. What is given? These are classified as the following heading, under the following headings: material things, fearlessness, education, life and limbs, merits, and the Dharma. So we're going to go through these six. The first is material things. This kind of giving is considered the lowest, occupies the lowest place in this hierarchy of gifts. But it's the one, of course, that we focus on most in this culture, the time of the holidays. I'm going to read an article from the New York Times about this whole matter of gift giving, materially speaking, of course. This is from a few days ago. The title of the article is A Gift That Gives Right Back, The Giving Itself. and this is by Tara Parker Pope. When my mom died a few years ago, my siblings and I were discussing the many ways life would be different without her. No more presents, my brother noted. My mother was passionate about gifts. As an adult, I often urged her to stop giving presents and spend the money on herself, but she refused. She liked giving gifts too much. Gift giving has long been a favorite subject for studies on human behavior with psychologists, anthropologists, economists, and marketers all weighing in. They have found that giving gifts is a surprisingly complex and important part of human interaction, helping to define relationships and strengthen bonds with family and friends. Indeed, psychologists say it is often the giver rather than the recipient who reaps the biggest psychological gains from a gift. Frustrated by crowds, traffic, and commercialism, people can be tempted at this time of year to opt out of gift giving altogether. A 2005 survey showed that 4 out of 5 Americans think the holidays are too materialistic, according to the Center for a New American Dream, which promotes responsible consumption. Elsewhere, I saw that someone called this time of year, instead of writing it as Xmas, they write it as Excess. The letter X / CESS. It goes on, but while it's reasonable to cut back on spending during the holidays, psychologists say that banning the gift exchange with loved ones is not the best solution. People who refuse to accept or exchange gifts during the holidays, these experts say, may be missing out on an important connection with family and friends. And then an Ellen Langer, a Harvard psychology professor, says, that doesn't do a service to the relationship. If I don't let you give me a gift, then I'm not encouraging you to think about me and think about things I like. I'm preventing you from experiencing the joy of engaging in all those activities. You do people a disservice by not giving them the gift of giving. Well, this is really, of course, we all know there's something to this, that ultimately you can't tease apart giving and receiving, yes, except in a material sense, but beyond that, there would be no one could give anything. No one would have the joy of giving unless someone received. This goes to this core Buddhist concept of the law of dependent co-arising. There could be no teachers without students. Your becoming a student of mine enables me to become a teacher, and vice versa. And you could just go through that with all of the dichotomies of relationships. He goes on, the social value of giving has been recognized throughout human history. For thousands of years, some native cultures have engaged in the potlatch, a complex ceremony that celebrates extreme giving. Although cultural interpretations vary, often the status of a given family in a clan or village was dictated not by who had the most possessions, but instead by who gave away the most. The more lavish and bankrupting the potlatch, the more prestige gained by the host family. You see this, you see traces of this in other cultures where it can be tainted by egoistic kind of competition. the most common form of it is arguing about who pays the restaurant bill, the restaurant check. And there is an innocent version of that where you just want to really want to give in a pure sense to the other person. And then there's the less pure version of it, where you want to show your dominance, your dominant status. I used to get this with my father, even when I was well into adulthood, where I would, you know, let him. He always insisted on paying for such things, and I could see that it was important to him, so I let him. But there was something. He got even a little angry when I, every once in a while, wanted to pay for something, and that anger was the revealing part. Anger always shows where we're stuck, where we're attached. Some researchers believe evolutionary forces may have favored gift-giving. Men who were the most generous may have had the most reproductive success with women. Okay, moving on. Couldn't be any truth in that. And then in parentheses, notably, the use of food in exchange for sexual access and grooming has been documented in our closest ape relative, the chimpanzee. Women who were skilled at giving, be it extra food or a well-fitted pelt, helped sustain the family provider as well as her children. Margaret Rucker, a consumer psychologist at the University of California, Davis, says men are typically more price-conscious and practical when it comes to the gifts they give and get, while women tend to be more concerned about giving and receiving gifts with emotional significance. Dr. Rucker says she often recounts the story of a man who climbed a tree to retrieve a robin's egg that matched his girlfriend's blue eyes. Women say, "Oh, how romantic," she said. But men say, "That's the dumbest thing I've ever heard of." And also, give us some credit, and also, what about the mama bird? Gender differences in gift-giving seem to emerge early in life. Researchers at Loyola University Chicago studied 3- and 4-year-olds at a daycare center, all of whom had attended the same birthday party. The girls typically went shopping with their mothers and helped select and wrap the gift. Boys, meanwhile, were often unaware of what the gift was. They'd say, "I took a nap while my mom went shopping for it." Gift-giving is often the most obvious way a partner can show interest, strengthen a bond, or even signal that a relationship should end. One colleague of Dr. Rucker's noted that she knew her marriage was over when her husband handed her a gift in a brown grocery bag. That's that practical stuff. People who stop giving gifts lose out on important social cues, researchers say. Who is on your gift list is telling you who is important in your life, Dr. McGrath said. It says who is more important and who is less important. But the biggest effect of gift giving may be on ourselves. Giving to others reinforces our feelings for them and makes us feel effective and caring. That's important. So I'm going to reread that. Giving to others reinforces our feelings for them. See, there's what we often talk about in Zen practice is embodying it. You know, same with a vow, not just thinking it, but speaking it. And here in this case, going even further and actually giving something concrete. That's why we We put flowers and fruit and other, sometimes other offerings on an altar, a standard altar, not just in Zen, but in Tibetan Buddhism and other kinds of Buddhism, has these basic offerings, fruit or vegetables, flowers. The incense itself is an offering, even the candles. And it's one of the most frequently asked questions we get from beginners is at workshops, introductory workshops, is what's the point of the flowers and fruit on the altar? It's a little hard to get across the importance, the significance of making it concrete, concretizing whatever feelings of respect, veneration, reverence, gratitude that we have toward our Buddha nature, the Buddha himself, for his tremendous efforts. But the closest we can come to doing that is to make it concrete. And that's, I think, really what is behind this. When she says, giving to others reinforces our feelings for them and makes us feel effective and caring. For a glimpse into the psychology of giving, researchers at Virginia Commonwealth University recently studied gift giving by pet owners, finding that it stemmed from a desire to make pets happy and offer gifts that would improve a pet's comfort and care. The research, to be published next year, may seem frivolous, but it also gives insight into the self-serving nature of giving, since pets can't reciprocate. Self-serving, I kept rereading that word. Self-serving sounds, I mean, usually when I hear it used, it means selfish, but the point is that in giving to a pet, there is a selfless quality to it because it's non-reciprocal. And this Tracy Ryan, professor of advertising research, says, when you're giving to another person, you have this pressure of reciprocity, but it's not there with a pet. It shows that a lot of the pleasure is in the giving, knowing you've taken care of someone. But here's the thing. At what cost to your own mental, at what cost in stress is it worth giving to how many people and what? I find with myself that this time of year, it really takes an effort to get out there, mostly to have to get to the malls and with the traffic and find something that isn't just a unnecessary kind of thing, but something that has some meaning to it. Or it's very difficult, especially since here at the center, this fourth quarter, October, November, December, is by far the busiest one of the year, where you can hardly catch our breath from one weekend to another and all the time in between preparing for these weekends. For each one of these six perfections, including dana, giving, one can do it, one can give with different degrees of attachment, ego attachment to it, wanting praise or wanting thanks and so forth. Paramita means perfection. And so when we say, like, for example, the dana paramita, it really means selfless giving, the height, the transcendent giving, where there is no sense of self or other. Some people find that they want to make gifts anonymous so that there is less ego involvement in it, less of wanting something back from it. And certainly that will, it doesn't guarantee there won't be, because they can always, to give anonymously, always there can be pride in making it anonymous. We know that. I have mixed feelings about anonymous gifts. I always want the gifts at Jukai, the monetary offerings to me as the teacher, to be anonymous so that no one can get concerned about amount at all. Same with a new student, with the little donations at the new student ceremony. But it is nice. On the other hand, at times and other situations, it's nice to be able to thank someone. That's nice. This week, three days ago, I came in, found a CD on my desk, gift wrapped, with no note from it, and I found myself wanting to know who left this. I want to thank him for it, but I can also appreciate the other side. It's still, even though I don't know who gave me the gift, there still is, it evokes gratitude. It's just not directed to anyone. Well, that's the first of the different categories of giving. Material things. The second is the giving of fearlessness. And Sangharakshita here writes, it's a uniquely Buddhist conception. He says that Buddhism seems more than any other religion. More than any other religion to realize the havoc which may be wrought in the mind by fear, worry, and anxiety. And so there's this emphasis on developing fearlessness. I think fearlessness may be a little too limited way a word. Anxietylessness, maybe. Because anxiety, really, when you look very deeply into this matter, anxiety is practically all pervasive in our lives. Heidegger, I love these words of Heidegger. He said, anxiety is there. It is only sleeping. Its breath quivers perpetually through man's being. Anyone who thinks they don't have anxiety at all is missing something. He says, in the sutras, the Buddha himself is invariably depicted as devoid of even the faintest trace of fear. His confidence is unshakable. Even here, this strains credibility that even the Buddha would have not the faintest, most subtle trace ever of anxiety. I think in the word anxiety is commonly understood as more something more significant than it needs to be. There's anxiety that gets in the way of our functioning in our relationships and our work. And then there's a much deeper anxiety that we can tickle awake in deep zazen. I think the primal fear or anxiety is the fear of not being. More commonly known as the fear of death, but really fear of death is just that. We don't know what death is. We imagine death, physical death, to be is where we disappear. And it's very common when one reaches a certain depth, a state of no thought, that one can have a fear, even a terror arise that is a complete surprise. One didn't know it was down there. He says here, yeah, fear, fear being essentially fear for oneself can be overcome only with the elimination of the ego sense. Absolute fearlessness is synonymous with enlightenment, that is, supreme perfect enlightenment. And the giving of fearlessness, here's the important part, the giving of fearlessness is equivalent ultimately to the conferring of enlightenment. In the present context, however, the giving of fearlessness means that the bodhisattva, when he says bodhisattva, he means anyone who is sincerely aspiring to realize oneself, anyone who is on the path, working seriously, means that the bodhisattva attempts to relieve people of anxiety with regard to person, property, and livelihood, either by providing material safeguards or psychotherapeutic treatment, or simply by means of his own radiant presence and confidence-inspiring behavior. It's interesting to me that he included here psychotherapeutic treatment, because this book goes back at least 30 years when psychotherapy was much less common than it is now. In this respect, we could say that that's one of the functions of a psychotherapist is to confer, to help the client work through fear and anxiety. It's a very valuable service, form of giving. Then he says that there are many spiritual exercises which aim at the conquest of fear, midnight visits to graveyards and other fearsome places, concentration on the various stages of decomposition in a corpse. These are not Zen things, but they are Buddhist things. Meditation on death are all practices in which fear, stimulated to the point at which it invades the conscious mind, can be faced and overcome. The enemy must be dragged out into the open before it can be slain. The third type of giving is that of education. It's important because it enables an individual to exercise his rights and perform his duties as a citizen, as a member of society. And secondly, because it's only when one has reached a certain level of general culture is it possible for one to understand the doctrines, Buddhist doctrines. Theories of education, of course, vary from age to age. The traditional Buddhist disciplines still upheld in Tibet and Mongolia comprise philosophy, logic, grammar, and medicine, together with the various arts, crafts, and sciences. And then he says, the bodhisattva gives only that education which is not incompatible with effective taking of the three treasures, the three refuges. In our society, it seems that it's rare, if not non-existent, that one comes to practice without having some level of education. Most of us, let's face it, most of us in the Sangha, in the North American Sangha, and I'm sure the European Sangha, are educated, fairly well educated. this is how Zen started in Japan. It started out as embraced by the elite, the intelligentsia, and the other elite at the time. When I was in China on pilgrimage, I saw people who I know were illiterate, who were fervent practitioners, but it hasn't seemed to have worked so far in our country. It seems that one has to. It's kind of a hierarchy of needs. When you grasp, when you reach a certain level of education, then you're more likely to think of transcendent matters, I suppose, and understand the nature of suffering, and that ultimately the only way out of suffering is to see through it, and not just try to address it with material things. The giving of education, because it's such a, because it is giving, dana, I think confirms why it is that teachers, school teachers, I'm talking about here, teaching has often been called the noblest profession. It's of course far more pure way of giving than just giving material things. It's such a comment on the sickness of our society that teachers are not held in higher regard, that students are so disrespectful to school teachers, and the fourth kind of giving is the giving away of life and limbs. These come from the Jataka tales, the story of the Buddha's previous lives. These outrageous stories of giving away, here's one. The one who offered his body to feed the starving tigress. Here's the problem with that, giving your body to feed a starving tigress, in case anyone's attempted to do that. According to the consensus of responsible Mahayana opinion, the body of the bodhisattva does not belong to himself, but to all beings. It is a sacred trust. Consequently, he has the right to sacrifice it only when the person for whom the sacrifice is made is able to render to people a service greater than his own. So the story of the starving tigress and other stories like that in the Jataka tales, really not to be taken literally, but as a way of expressing. And this would have been, in former times, could have been for the illiterate, a way of expressing the importance of developing compassion to such an extent that one has no thought for oneself. That's really what it stands for. And we see that, we saw that in during the Vietnam War with these remarkable Vietnamese monks who set fire to themselves to protest the war. I would so much want to know more about those monks who did that. It's not fair to call that suicide, because what little that did come to us about that was that these were at least one of them. Remember the one? There's one in particular that just galvanized the anti-war movement. that he was a senior monk. And this would be the equivalent here, life and limbs, of that he may have known that if this were picked up on the wire services and sent around, that it would have the effect it did. It had a tremendous effect on people. The fifth kind of giving is the making a gift of one's merits, which we call transferring merit. Now, this is something we do every day here at the center, and that we all participate in. We now return the merit of our chanting to. A little bit more on this, because we do it so often. Merit, of course, is what we are said to gain whenever we give, basically, give of ourselves one way or another. Together with the transferring of merits is the importance of self-surrender. When we say we now return the merit of our chanting to Shakyamuni Buddha, Manjusri Bodhisattva, Avalokita Bodhisattva, Bahadra Bodhisattva. One way I heard this expressed is that we're turning it over to these great enlightened beings as our agents, and they can disperse it as necessary. But the main point is dana, giving up, letting go, surrendering the self. And the sixth and last category of giving is give it the gift of the Dharma. And the way he interprets this is, it's being able to share one's understanding of the Dharma and practice with others. And this is, it is important. I too often hear of people who mention that someone asks them about their sitting, what Zen is, and they say, I don't know, I'm just a beginner, I don't know anything about this. And that is to be remiss, that you're denying someone the opportunity to have their interest kindled and broadened. So there's a responsibility that comes with practice. No matter how little you've been sitting, you can always teach people how to sit, the basics. You know, sit in a stable position, either cross-legged or kneeling, or a chair. Sit still. Put your hands together, describe just the basics, keep your back straight, eyes are open but lowered slightly, count from 1 to 10. Anyone can do this. Don't begrudge people this if they really ask for it. But it goes beyond that. If people ask, what is Zen? Okay, then it's a little more understandable that you would say, I don't know. After all, Bodhidharma. I don't know is good enough for Bodhidharma. But this is different. Don't take that excuse. Do it the best you can. And if you feel like you're fumbling and inadequate, well, maybe you should do a little more reading about it so that you can articulate it a little better. It doesn't have to be a teisho. It's just something to help people understand. It's a Zen is a Japanese word that means meditation. It's the school that emphasizes that that we can come to understand ourselves and others and reality through meditation, and then through that to be able to give more, to be more of service and help to others, anything. So this is what he would call the sixth, the gift of Dharma. But I would go beyond that. Now, that doesn't go nearly far enough. And say that the ultimate gift, the ultimate form of dana, of giving, is Zazen itself. Not just Zazen where you're sitting and thinking about your shopping list or what you're going to make for dinner, but Zazen where you're more or less free of thoughts. That is the ultimate giving. You just, when we're sitting like that, we're just like a beacon radiating light through the universe. And even short of that, we're purifying our minds. We're dissolving the neurotic aspects of our character and personality that prevent us from giving more fully to others, that prevent us from loving more others more, and being more sensitive and attuned to others, and more responsive to others. Zazen is the root, the fundamental way to develop responsiveness, of being able to respond to people in need. It transcends all kinds of giving. It is the Dana Paramita, Zazen. Time is up. We'll stop now and recite the four vows.